Arm's Length Reporting, for investors who want the whole story. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey, welcome in. Time for KER Politics. Got a real treat for you guys out there. Today, I am chatting with Professor Joshua Mitchell. He has affiliations with Washington University back in D.C. And also with Claremont McKenna in California. Both incredibly great schools. Josh is a professor of primarily politics, government, I guess is the correct way to put it. After chatting with him off mic for close to half an hour, I have to say he is one of the best qualified individuals I have ever chatted with regarding American politics. Josh, thank you so much for taking your time, sir.
My pleasure, Al. Good to speak with you.
Hey, Josh, I'm scared to death about what's going on in the country right now. Do you have an opinion, sir?
Well, I am as well. It was supposed to be the year of unity, and it doesn't look like it's going to be. I'm characterizing this year as the year of the scapegoat. It looks to me that anyone who is somehow opposed to the agenda of the Biden administration and more broadly to identity politics is going to be labeled an insurrectionist or a racist, and this is really a terrible condition for our country to be in.
Well, I got to tell you, I'm far from a racist, and I can prove that in many, many ways by my own actions, etc. I hate to have somebody label me in a derogatory sense like that. What do you think, Josh, the agenda of the Liberal Party is right now?
Well, it looks to me like they're going to double down on identity politics, and that's what I wrote about in my book, American Awakening, Identity Politics and Other Afflictions in Our Time. The idea of identity politics is very different than what America was founded on. And I should just say something very briefly about that.
I'd like you to.
America was founded on limited government. But you know, and I could talk about the founders and sing their praise. But really what that means was that the people who founded the country believed that American citizens didn't need a strong armed government. That through our institutions, our families, our churches, our civic associations, and our capacity for self-government, we could get most of the work done by ourselves. And so I call that the liberal politics of competence. And liberal doesn't mean left. We have to be very clear. There's left, liberal, and conservative. So the Americans were liberal in the old classical sense, and they believed in the competence of their citizens. So what I set up in the book and what I think is the real challenge for us today is the tension between the liberal politics of competence and what I call the identity politics of innocence and transgression. And that's the direction the left is moving. And what I mean by that is that the left increasingly is of the mind that the only question that's relevant is whether you are an innocent victim or whether you're one of the guilty transgressors who's responsible for the victimhood of the innocents. Now, make no mistake about it. I am not saying America is pure. There's no country on earth that's pure. The question, though, for me is whether the rule of law and the Constitution and the checks and balances we have in place are adequate to address the problems that we have. And I think the civil rights movement suggested that it was. And my concern is that what identity politics wants to do is completely throw out this constitutional order of the American founders because they say America is systemically racist, that people who wrote it, the Constitution, were guilty of whiteness, and so whiteness is now a crime. This is a really horrible moment for our country. We have to be able to build a world together with people we disagree with.
Yes.
And if we don't, our lunch is going to be eaten by China, frankly, which is already about to exceed us in terms of its gross domestic product. So we have to return to the liberal politics of competence and stop thinking about each other as guilty of some sort of transgression and crime. Even if we just arrived here, you know, 5-10 years ago as immigrants, somehow we're guilty of crimes from the period of slavery. I don't believe in collective guilt. I do believe in collective responsibility. If the least among us in our country are struggling, and many of those are blacks, we have a responsibility. That's collective responsibility, not collective guilt. But what the left is doing is invoking collective guilt with a view to destroying everything that we've built. And that's been always the agenda of the hard left, is to destroy the existing state of things. And that's not acceptable. We can't build a world that way.
You know, I got a question for you that I think is really, really relevant here. And that is, I want to talk about a couple of the leaders of the left. Number one, Nancy Pelosi, and number two, Chuck Schumer. Nancy Pelosi has to be incredibly bright to have reached the status that she has reached within the Democratic Party. I don't agree with a lot of what Speaker Pelosi has to say, but one thing I'm very concerned about is I'm giving her a lot of credit, saying that she's a great politician. There's no question about that. I simply don't understand her philosophy, and I don't understand Schumer's philosophy, and I'm not at all as familiar with Chuck Schumer as I am with Speaker Pelosi. What is the rationale, in your opinion, sir, behind the two leaders of the Democratic Party right now?
Well, Nancy Pelosi is a very interesting character, and like you, I can't speak too much to Chuck Schumer, but let me say something about Nancy Pelosi. Nancy Pelosi's father was the mayor of Baltimore.
Right.
And Baltimore, like so many cities in the mid-20th century and still today, was a city run like a patronage network. So you figure out who you want to have on your side, you somehow get resources to them, and that's how you build a coalition. And that's Nancy Pelosi's genius. She learned from her father how to build a patronage coalition, a coalition of dependencies, so to speak. Now, Nancy Pelosi she's not as left as she needs to be at the moment. And what I mean by that is that she and Schumer and Biden, and I would actually even put in Hillary Clinton, while they lean left, they're not really hard left. Mm-hmm. But I think what Pelosi has concluded as a consequence of her dealings with AOC and a number of others who in the younger members of the Democratic Party, and as a consequence of her watching Bernie Sanders and that whole wing of the party, she has concluded that she's going to try to be the broker for the whole thing. And here I think we have to recognize there's a tremendous instability in the Democratic Party, just as the Republican Party continues to be pulled apart between those who, let's call them the neoconservatives and the free market types on the one hand, and let's call them the Trumpists on the other hand, who believe in modest international positioning abroad, returning our trade to, or returning our manufacturing to the country, saying that families and institutions matter as much as markets. I mean, that's the new development in the Republican Party. And it's not going to go away now that Trump has won. But there is still a tension within the Republican Party. In the Democratic Party, to come back to Pelosi, there's a war. There's a war between those who want to go hard left and the older generation. And this is Schumer, Pelosi, Biden, and Clinton. And I think that what we have to watch is the extent to which Nancy Pelosi can give the hard left a bit of what it wants, but still maintain control of the Democratic Party. Because, as you said, she's smart enough to know that if you go hard left, the Democratic Party is going to be thrown out. So that's what we really need to watch. Does Biden come up with policies which appease portions of the left, or does he really capitulate to the left? And the same is true of Pelosi. This is the thing to watch. You know, there's two populist movements in America. We forget this. There's the one that ultimately voted for Trump, which began with the Tea Party movement. But then there's the other one, far left, the Occupy Wall Street movement.
Yeah.
And that one, very briefly, is the one that's at war now with the old, the guard, Clintons, the Pelosi's, the Schumer's, the Bidens.
Yep. Josh, we've got to take a real quick break here for a commercial. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to be right back with one of the most interesting guests I've had in a long time, Josh Mitchell. Thank you, sir. Be right back.
Your weekly fix on finance and investing. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
Okay, I want to mention one thing, by the way, quite apart from the segment, the subject of this segment, and that is please support our sponsors. Big Al gets nothing out of that, but we are providing great information on all of the radio stations that we are on, in my opinion, so let's support the sponsors of those stations. Sir, getting back to Pelosi and Schumer and Biden, I am seeing a development in my mind, anyway, within Joe Biden. I mean, I keep in mind that my favorite columnist, Peggy Noonan, said that of all of the people on the Beltway, all of the politicians on the Beltway, she mentioned, made this comment about 2-3 years ago, Joe Biden was the most respectful, the most polite, and in her opinion, very, very honest, et cetera, et cetera. What happened there? Did he veer away from that, in your opinion, sir?
It's really hard to say where Joe Biden is. He's, you know, he has adjusted during his entire 40-plus year career. Originally, glad handling Senator Byrd, who is an avowed Ku Klux Klan member, you know, that's what you could do, and that's what you did do when he began. And now it's the hard left politics. And again, to come back to Pelosi, they've both been around for a very long time.
Oh, yeah.
They know
how
to build coalitions. And it's not clear to me that they're doing this because they believe it or because they know that if they build a coalition with people whom they even disagree, there'll be immense power here. So I think, you know, my own judgment is that Pelosi and Biden are not as far left as some of the policies they're going to. Part of the problem, quite frankly, in the world of identity politics, if you're white, you have a problem.
Yep.
There's a way that you can buy your innocence. And this is woke capitalism. It's what they call virtue signaling, but it's not virtue. Virtue is a Greek, it's really innocence signaling, signaling that you too are among the innocent. And so what has to happen if you're white, really, and you're part of the left, is you have to go overboard, show that you're really not for whiteness, which means you have to double down on identity politics, projects, prove to your client base, which is suspicious of whiteness, and the hard left really is, that you're not one of them. And this played out in the Trump years in the following way. You know, there's a tremendous tension in as it were, the white race. I hate using that term. But among whites, is precisely because you're labeled as a transgressor, as somehow guilty just by virtue of the color of your face. There was a dance that got done during the Trump administration. What you had to do to show that you were an innocent white person behind all the so-called people of color, another term I really detest, but what you have to do is to show that you're not like those other white people. And so you had tremendous animosity toward Trump and his deplorables. It was to show that you are among the innocents and on the proper moral arc of history, you had to distance yourself from those white people. It was really, really troubling. It's troubling for me because the task of politics is not to call out whether we're white or black or anything else. The task of politics is for us to work together, quite irrespective of our colors, to build a world together. And that has been the success of America, and that's what we must return to. But identity politics makes that impossible, because if you're one of the stained people, and purity and stain are the great categories within identity politics, if you are a stained person, then there's no way you have any credibility. And that can't be right.
Well, I mean, we could talk forever, and I would like to do that at some point in the future about why our society has evolved into that. I think one of the most intelligent presidents, somebody who I absolutely do not agree with, who's responsible for this, and he was very effective because of his persona and because of his great amount of intelligence, was Barack Obama. Some things happened during his administration that to me were absolutely amazing in terms of, I mean, you look at the situation and some of the riots that occurred during those years. You look at the amount of hatred that and venom and vitriol that is now directed at the law enforcement officers in our country. I think that was a result possibly of some of the things where he went a bit overboard. Any comments on that real quick? I don't want to dwell on that, but go ahead.
Sure. No. So Barack Obama is he's a dignified man who speaks
beautifully.
He's one of the great orators since, pick your time, maybe since John F. Kennedy as a president. And he did inspire a nation, and I think he inspired the nation with the promise that we could move to a post-racial society. But what actually happened in the Obama administration was that if you disagreed with him, his policies, which were pretty much leftward policies, if you disagreed with him, you were called a racist.
Right.
And that racialized politics to the point where it became impossible to have real arguments. You simply agreed or dismissed a person based on the color of their skin. So yes, whether he wanted to or not, by virtue of, I think, the moment that we were in, my argument is identity politics has been brewing for the last 10 or 20 years, and it first showed up in the Obama administration. By virtue of the moment that we're in, you know, you can see this really taking off during the Obama administration. The left never gave up on the idea that Trump was a racist. I don't know that he was or that he wasn't. I have lots of black friends and colleagues who voted for him. They said, I don't care if he's a racist. He brought jobs to blacks, the highest unemployment rate. Or employment rate in a long time. So that's where we are. The only thing that matters is whether you're a racist or not, whether you're white or not, or a person of color. You cannot build the world on that kind of politics. And that's what the left is trying to do.
Yes, they are. Now, here's the million-dollar question. Do you think they're going to succeed?
No. And I'll give you two reasons why I think they won't. For one, the identity politics of innocence and transgression, as I call it, cares nothing about competence. The issue is whether you've got the right number of blacks or Hispanics in a particular institution, and that's all that matters. You know, if we go to war with China, it's not going to matter the racial breakdown. We're going to have competent people in there, and I don't care if they're black or Hispanic or white. I simply don't care. I want to know if they're competent. So we've lived in this moment since 1989 when we beat the Soviet Union, where America has not had a foreign rival. And this idea that we don't have to think about competence has taken hold of our imagination. So as China rises, we're either going to completely collapse and hold out and with the belief that identity politics is the only thing that matters, and our society will become, will get crushed, or we're going to return to the liberal politics of competence. Very briefly, there is one group in America that can put an end to this tomorrow, and that's black Americans. Because the argument has been, as civil rights goes, so goes women's rights, so goes gay rights, and so goes transgender rights. And my sense is that in the black community, that's actually not an argument that holds much weight. Many blacks say, look, if women want to talk about their issues, that's fine. If gays want to talk about their issues and transgenders, that's fine. But you don't get to use the moral authority of the civil rights movement. And
Professor,
and you're right on that one because...
Yeah,
go ahead. We'll
Professor Mitchell, unfortunately, we have to stop here. We're out of time. I will definitely contact your publicist, Sandy. I'm going to get you back on the show within a couple of weeks if you can do that. Thank you, sir.
To find out more about today's guests, visit us on the web at www.kereport.com. You're listening to the Corlin Economics Report. We'll be back in a moment. Providing unique reporting on markets and companies since 1990. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey, welcome in, time for the second half of KER Politics. I've got a very, very interesting and knowledgeable individual on the line with me, Dr. John R. Lott. Dr. Lott is in charge of an organization called CrimeResearch.org. He's one of the foremost experts in the country on the pros and cons of gun control. He's just the guy I want to talk to right now, given the fact of what the current executive branch is attempting to push through regarding the Second Amendment. Just to refresh our radio listeners, what the executive branch is trying to push through right now is to be able to hold culpability on the part of the sellers of guns if a gun which they sold were ever involved in an altercation, they would be liable for it, as opposed to the owner, which I think is absolutely ridiculous. Dr. Lott, I'd like to go on here. I'd like to give you as much time as you want, And I'd like you to make the argument, if this only if this is your argument, and I know that it is, that guns don't kill people. People kill people. You're on, sir.
Well, thanks. Guns obviously make it easier to kill people, but they also make it easier for people to protect themselves and prevent bad things from happening. And the question usually is, what's the net effect? The change in the liability rules that Biden wants to get through don't really look at the balancing there. If a gun maker makes a defective gun that injures somebody, or if they sell a gun illegally, they don't do the proper background check, either the manufacturer or the seller, and they sell it to somebody who then goes and does some harm with the gun, they are liable. But what this would do is, in those cases where the gun wasn't defective, where the manufacturers and sellers followed the law completely and perfectly, they would be liable for any harm that would occur from the gun. And, you know, just think what that would imply if that was applied to other industries. For example, there are 4.5 million people who are injured in car accidents each year. So you have somebody who, through no fault of Ford or General Motors, maybe is texting while they're driving, or maybe they just aren't paying attention for some other reason, and they get into an accident. Should Ford be liable for the medical costs? Should they be liable for the lost wages? Should they be liable for pain and suffering? And what would that do to the car industry if they were to have those types of rules in place? Obviously, it would dramatically increase the price of cars and put probably many of the car makers and sellers out of business, which I think is the whole purpose for this in the case of guns. But, you know, this isn't the only thing that they're doing. Just last week, people may remember Operation Choke Point under the Obama administration, where they would go after industries, firms and industries that they didn't like, perfectly legal firms, and it was primarily gun makers, and put pressure on financial institutions to no longer do business with either gun makers or gun sellers. So if you wanted to have a checking account, you'd be denied being able to have a checking account. If you wanted to have a bank process credit cards, for customers who wanted to buy things with credit cards, they would refuse to do that. It was just a way to try to put gun makers and gun sellers out of business and to make it much more costly for them to do business. It made it so many gun makers couldn't get loans. They couldn't issue stocks or bonds because financial institutions, because of pressure from the federal government, couldn't do that. Well, Trump had started regulatory changes to make it so that the federal government couldn't put that type of pressure on financial institutions who were dealing with law-abiding, legitimate companies. I mean, it's one thing to deal with criminal entities, but to go and deal with a company that's following the law completely is another story. The problem is, in part because of the bureaucracy, that those regulatory changes were not quite finished. They were issued in November, but they have to be published in the Federal Register, and they were just about to be published when the new Biden administration pulled them and kept them from being published. So it essentially means that the Biden administration is going to be able to go back to the same type of Operation Choke Point type rules that existed at the end of the Obama administration and put many, many companies and sellers out of business.
You know, I don't want to digress from this subject at all, but I just want to make kind of one comment from the outside, looking at the outside in. The current executive office is currently looking to, in my opinion, do away with, number one, the First Amendment, and number two, do away with the Second Amendment. Scares the daylights out of me, John.
Well, I understand what you're saying. It's just that, you know, elections have consequences.
Yes, they do,
on this
sir.
Stuff. And it's not too much that can be done because the Biden administration controls the regulatory process right now. And you're not going to get too much direct help from the courts because the regulatory cases go through the D.C. Circuit, and the Democrats completely control the D.C. Circuit. They have a 7-4 majority on the court there, and you know, so it's not going to be good as far as that goes. And, yeah. You know, elections have consequences.
Yes, they do. Well, I got to tell you, I think H.R. 127, if the Biden administration, I don't think it's just Joe Biden, so let me say, if the current executive office really can beat down the Second Amendment, I think that's a harbinger of some very negative things to come from the results of this particular election. And I really mean that, Dr. Lott. There's no question about it. I want to ask you one question because we're going to have to take a commercial break in about 2 minutes. What instigated your interest in this subject, sir? I mean, you're a PhD economist. Near as I can tell, you've never been the president of the National Rifle Association. Is it just common sense, or why do you have this passion, sir?
Well, I kind of got into this by accident. I had done a lot of work on crime. I'd been chief economist at the U.S. Sentencing Commission, and I published a lot of academic articles on crime-related topics. And I was teaching for about 5 years at the Wharton Business School. And one time I made the mistake of telling the students that we were ahead in the syllabus. And you know, that I had a couple students come up to me after class and ask me, they said, well, they realized it wasn't quite on topic for the class, but they asked me if we had time, if I could spend a little bit of time talking about gun control. And while I had read some papers, academic papers in the area, they were all pretty horrible, and I just assumed that there were better papers someplace else. But when I started looking through it to prepare for the class, I was just pretty shocked how poorly done the existing research was.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're an academic, one of the reasons why you do research is you think you can do a better job than other people
right,
have done.
Right.
And so anyway, that's kind of what happened there, and just kind of fell into it by accident.
Very interesting thing to come out of a former academician at a great school like Wharton and at another great school like UCLA. Wharton, in my opinion, has probably one of the greatest graduate programs of any university in the country. And I'm jealous that you are on the faculty there and I never was. Ladies and gentlemen, we're going to take a real quick commercial break here. Going to be right back with Dr. Lott. I'm going to talk about his organization, which I would suggest you use as a source of information on this subject. Okay, back to wrap up KER Politics, KE Politics, I guess I should say. We are back talking with Dr. Lott. Big Al still has a bad throat. I'm very sorry about that, and I hope you can understand me as clearly as my thoughts are coming out of my brain. You started an organization that I would like you to, number one, describe right now, and number two, I'd like you to hit on some of the highlights that you think your organization has accomplished since its inception, sir.
Sure. The Crime Prevention Research Center
yes,
is basically a group of academics. People can find our website at crimeresearch.org, crimeresearch.org. And, you know, I started it with academics from Harvard and the Wharton Business School and University of Chicago and University of Michigan, people who have expertise in a wide range of areas dealing with crime. You know, we've done everything from policing to police shootings to gun control to corporate crime to a whole range of areas, vote fraud, You know, there's a large range of, you know, how technology helps solve crime. There's a large range of topics that we've covered with the expertise that we have. You know, it's, but I suppose a lot of the work that we've done has been on the issue of gun control. We have people on both sides of the kind of the debate, academic debate, in our organization. And that's hopefully the way to go and make sure you produce top quality research, have people debate and argue about points. But, you know, I'm probably myself best known for my book, More Guns, Less Crime, from the University of Chicago Press, went through three editions. But, you know, people can find a lot of information on kind of the false claims that are being made about guns and gun control on our website, crimeresearch.org. I'll just give you one example of the type of research that we've done. You know, we frequently hear, you know, that the claim by gun control people that guns on net are bad. If that's true, you would think that whenever places have banned guns, either all guns or all handguns, you would see drops in murder and homicide rates. And yet, every single time that all guns have been banned, or all handguns have been banned, you see large increases in murder rates. You think out of randomness, once or twice, you would get a situation where murder rates had at least stayed the same or fallen, just out of randomness. But in fact, the opposite's true. And it turns out there's a very simple explanation for that, and that is you have to be very careful when you pass gun control laws that you're not primarily disarming law-abiding good citizens. You may take some guns away from criminals, but, you know, just as criminals can go and get illegal drugs, they end up being able to go and get guns. And if you primarily disarm law-abiding citizens relative to criminals, you actually make it easier for criminals to go out and commit crime.
You know, I find that to be, I mean, absolutely very true. I'm a very Second Amendment advocate. There's no question about that. And you know what's funny about that? I don't happen to own a gun, and I don't have a weapon in the house, but there's a very logical reason for that. And the logical reason is purely and simply, I don't have the expertise. And I know one thing that the NRA and the gun dealers who I know stress over and over and over again is don't even think about buying this weapon unless you have the expertise to actually use it. You know, I have a close friend, just kind of a bit of an aside. He's a retired professor at the at Washington University in the medical school. He has contributed on a worldwide scale, is well known internationally for the work that he has done in medicine in terms of imaging. And the only reason I bring this up is because anybody who's gotten to his particular status of life has an IQ certainly somewhat above 62. But I have to say, he went out and bought a handgun, went down to the local range that is very, very pro-education, and he spent probably 6 or 7 months educating himself. And I've got to tell you, I have no concerns about how this fellow will ever, he'll never misuse this because he's taken a lot of care. The people who misuse guns, in my opinion, sir, are those who acquire them illegally.
Right. Well, I mean, what you find, for example, you look at people with concealed handgun permits.
Right.
There are about 20 million Americans that have concealed handgun permits. And they're incredibly law-abiding with few problems. So I'll give you an example. Police are convicted of misdemeanors or felonies at about 1/20th the rate of the general population.
Mm-hmm.
Concealed handgun permit holders are convicted at a rate of 1/10th the rate of police officers.
Yeah.
So they're 1/200th the rate of the general population. And if you look at firearms-related violations, you see a similar type of, extreme law-abidingness by permit holders. When you're talking about law-abiding citizens, they have a lot to lose. if they go and use a gun improperly. It's, you know, easy to become a felon. And that would radically alter people's lives, and they tend to be very careful as a result of that.
Well, I know one thing in my neck of the woods, excuse me, which happens to be the Great Northwest. If you discharge a firearm and hit somebody or whatever, you are guaranteed, absolutely 100% guaranteed, of a significant and major lawsuit against your action. So you better know what you're doing. I have a close friend who is the sheriff of our county, and Dave Elfo. And Dave and I have discussed the issue of gun control ad nauseum. And he has backed up everything, John, that you are saying right now. Absolutely everything.
Well,
so, I guess the only question I have... you may want to sidestep this question, but when society gets to the point, in my opinion, where they want to defund the police officers because of a very small minority of bad apples, that scares the daylights out of me, sir.
Well, I understand that. On our website, one of the things we track is just some of the media bias,
right,
in television shows. You know, television show after television show shows white supremacists using what are machine guns to go and do mass public shootings.
Right.
And, it's really amazing. You know, the FBI shows on CBS, the SWAT show on TV, Magnum PI. And, we've had like two murders in the United States since the 1930s involving machine guns.
Yeah.
And, they talk about these as being AR-15, so they're misinforming people about that. Plus, the neo-Nazi or white supremacy angle, I mean, it fits in very closely with what Bloomberg's Everytown has been putting out. But if we have gone through and looked at the political beliefs and affiliations of mass public shooters, and what you find is that there's only a few percent who believe in neo-Nazi or white supremacy type stuff. It's basically the same percentage that do these attacks because of, you know, environmental beliefs.
Right.
And the overwhelming, you know, 90% of these mass public shooters, they have no political beliefs, really, no political affiliations. They are just suicidal individuals who believe that they can go and get media attention by killing people. You know, someplace along the line, you know, 30 years ago or whatever, people realized that if they're going to commit suicide, maybe they can do it in a way that will let people know that they were here and that they will get a lot of media attention. The more people they kill, the more media attention they get.
I want to just wrap this up by saying one thing. There are too many misconceptions, sir, about gun control, too many misconceptions about guns. I appreciate your insight. I'm going to post all the information that I can on your organization. Thank you, John.
The Corlin Economics Report is produced for A.B. Corlin and Associates. Opinions expressed on this program are intended solely for the entertainment of our listeners, do not constitute investment advice, and are not necessarily those of this network, radio station, or our sponsors. Find out more about this program and today's guests by visiting www.kereport.com. For Al Corlin, this is Colleen Robbins. Join us again next week for the Corlin Economics Report.